Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, normally we don't do things that veer into politics much, and really that's partisan politics. But we're going to talk about something today that does have political implications, and it's something that's in the news a lot and probably will be continuing to be in the news for the foreseeable future, unfortunately. And the topic is basically ISIS and social media, ISIS being the Islamic State terrorist organization in the Middle East. My guest today is an expert on that topic. His name is J.M. Berger. He is a fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and is in charge of its project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world. Now, there's an easy job for you.
I'm not actually in charge of it.
Well, I figured you would object. But anyway, he's he's one of the people who is studying, is involved in that project, right? U.S. relations with the Islamic world. And one thing I am sure of is that with co-author Jessica Stern, he's written a book published in spring 2015 called ISIS, The State of Terror. So welcome, Mr. Berger.
Thank you for having me.
From now on, we're going to call you JM. And if you would, just tell us briefly, what is ISIS? How did it come to exist?
Well, ISIS is the successor group to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, jihadists started to move into the country to fight off the U.S. forces. It was an opportunity for them to strike a blow at the Americans. And one of the key figures who did this was a man named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He had been long on the fringes of Al-Qaeda. He was too violent and too sectarian, even for Al-Qaeda's tastes. But he was out early in Iraq, and he was very successful quickly. So Al-Qaeda agreed to bring his organization into the fold, and it became the first of Al-Qaeda's franchises outside of Afghanistan. The organization got beaten down by the U.S. surge in 2007 and the rise of what's called the Sunni Awakening Movement, basically Sunni tribes that were sick of the violence that was plaguing their home, and they banded together to fight off Al-Qaeda in Iraq in exchange for promises that they would be included in the political process in Iraq. And for a while, the group was really reduced to a very small level. And then what happened was, after we left in 2011, the Iraqi government didn't carry through on its promises to the Sunni tribesmen who had fought Al-Qaeda, and that really undermined the entire process of beating back this organization, which was now calling itself the Islamic State. So the organization started to enjoy a resurgence, first in Iraq and then in Syria, where a gigantic civil war was breaking out over the horrors of the Assad regime. And the positioning of the Islamic State on the border allowed it to move people and resources back and forth, and allowed it to exploit the rising tide of jihadists flowing into Syria to fight Assad. And taken together, this really just allowed the group to reconstitute itself in a very dramatic way. And what we saw was that this resurgence started in 2012, as early as 2012, and crested in 2013 and 2014 with the seizure of really large amounts of territory in Iraq and Syria. And then in June of 2014, they declared themselves to be a state, to be the caliphate, which is a concept that has huge resonance in Muslim history. And they have established themselves in a very strong way. They've suffered some setbacks, but they've also enjoyed some gains at the same time. They've been expanding internationally, even as they sort of hold their line in Syria and Iraq. And that sort of brings us where we are today, which is this very large organization that shows no signs of going away anytime soon.
Yeah, so I mentioned at the beginning that our topic today, our focus within the subject of ISIS, is on their use of social media. So, you know, I was thinking in the 80s, there was a kind of liberal idealistic expression, think globally, act locally. And you saw it a lot on bumper stickers. And ISIS, I think, has put that notion into practice, not as a bumper sticker, but as a recruiting campaign directed at people throughout the world, especially in Europe and North America. And to do it, they use online marketing and communication tools, particularly social media such as Facebook and Twitter and, I guess, Instagram. And the act locally they have in mind isn't using less water on your lawn or whatever. It's terrorist acts, basically kill where you are or come join us. So let's talk about that, Jim. Why don't you compare their recruiting strategy with that of Al-Qaeda, which I think is totally different and at a totally different level of sophistication.
So, yeah, they're really one way that ISIS has distinguished itself is its use of social media, and that's really in many ways responsible for my interest in the group, and you know, the fact that I was kind of paying attention to them a little earlier than a lot of other people were. I had done a study in 2012 on extremist use of social media, and that study had looked at white supremacists. And in the course of that, we sort of developed some tools that were, you know, really useful for examining a population of people online. So around the end of 2013, starting September, and then even, you know, going into the end of 2013, I had this app, software app for analyzing Twitter networks, and I was looking for something interesting to point it at. And right around the same time, ISIS was really firing up its online machinery, and so it started very early pointed, sort of recommended itself to me as something that was interesting because of the social media mechanics. And when I started to look at the social media mechanics, it became clear pretty quickly that there was a lot going on here that went beyond just the social media realm. So ISIS was very early in this arena. Al-Qaeda had used social media and the internet in various creative ways before, but it was always driven by operational security concerns. So, you know, they didn't maintain an always-on kind of presence. Their key leaders were really isolated, as we found out after the death of Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. You know, in some cases, people were just carrying, you know, literally carrying his messages from one town to the next before they would upload them to the internet for security reasons. And ISIS, because it controls territory and because it has chosen to prioritize this, it's much, much more accessible online. So there was a group of ISIS supporters who are very active online, and they're many of them are based in sort of Iraq and Syria, but a lot of them are based elsewhere. And they formed a core group of people who were really dedicated to pushing out its message, including its challenge to Al-Qaeda. ISIS had decided pretty early on, although it didn't become completely overt until 2014, that it was the rightful leader of the global jihadist movement, not Al-Qaeda. So that challenge was first mounted online. In the years before this, jihadists had used message boards. They'd used these kind of bulletin board type setups where somebody ran the board, and it was like a place where you could go and have conversations and make comments, but there was a moderator who could say, you know, we're not talking about this, or they could delete a post that you put up if it was controversial, or they could throw you off the forum if you were persistently disruptive. Mm-hmm. So because there were these kind of surging disagreements in the movement at that time, a lot of people fled the boards for social media because they couldn't express themselves freely on the message boards. And, you know, it's sometimes comical to kind of our sensibilities, but I mean, they would often, you know, I had a conversation with one of these guys online where he's like, you know, well, jihadis want free speech too. And it's like, you know, it's kind of Western concept that was really kind of new in the movement. So before the rise of the social media element, when you were in a jihadist group, you either participated in the real world, in which case you, like, you know, you went to a training camp, you lived in an environment that was very tightly controlled and indoctrinated, or you engaged on these message boards where things could be very tightly controlled. And so social media was the Wild West for these guys. They just, like, you know, suddenly were free to say what they wanted, and a lot of fractures really opened up and became very visible very quickly. So ISIS wasn't really in a position to exploit that because they had put resources on this and building a presence. And so pretty soon they were outperforming Al-Qaeda in Syria in a very dramatic way. Even though they had fewer followers online, their message would get out more effectively because they were so active and so smart about how they did it. So that's really where it all started. And then from there, we've seen this just mushroom out into what we see today, which is where lone wolf style attacks are being encouraged successfully. And they really have their tendrils out all over the world using this method.
So I haven't seen any of this myself, but how slick is the message? I mean, to an American or to a British citizen, does it sound very foreign and stilted, or is it just very slick marketing, almost like you'd get from a corporation?
Their marketing is very strong, so they have different kinds of messaging that are aimed at different audiences. When Al-Qaeda in Iraq really was an early innovator in a kind of this online presence, and they put out videos, just hundreds of videos, you know, at a very high pace compared to Al-Qaeda, which would put something out, you know, every couple months, and it would often be very static. It would involve, you know, somebody giving a speech, looking at the camera for 45 minutes, and it wasn't real engaging, even though that word slick that you use, I mean, it was constantly applied to what Al-Qaeda's propaganda online. During that time, and now ISIS has completely inherited the mantle of that. So the original Al-Qaeda in Iraq stuff was more distinguished by its violence than by its production values. So they really innovated the overwhelming kind of use of these execution videos. And they put out, I saw at least 80 videos that they put out that were just like horrific executions with very little other content. And where ISIS has improved on the model is they've kept a lot of that violent content, but they've added storylines and they've added production value. So they put out something that looks like it was made by a cable channel or a documentary from, you know, a Hollywood producer. Some of the stuff that they do is really at that level. They also have innovated a lot of different techniques in how they depict the battles. So Al-Qaeda in Iraq would upload a lot of battle footage. So there'd be like, you'd see like a grainy picture of a distant truck, you know, that would get hit by a suicide bomber, and you see a distant explosion, and they would upload dozens and dozens of these things. And they were popular videos at the time. But what ISIS does now is much more planned. They think about the media play for these things in advance. They use high definition cameras. They've used GoPro. So they'll like have somebody will go out with a gun and take part in combat with a GoPro strapped to their hat. And so you get these images that are very reminiscent of a video game like Call of Duty, where like a first person shooter where somebody's like running around and you're sitting behind their gun. And so all of this stuff is pretty compelling, and the slickness of their propaganda is important. But, you know, what really I think makes the difference is that their social media presence follows on to that. So they put out this propaganda that's very compelling, that captures people's interest, but then they have, like, you know, a small army of people who will follow up. When somebody watches that video, somebody comments on that video, they will talk to that person and they will try and draw them in, and they do this kind of one-on-one engagement that is really a very powerful tool for them.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with J.M. Berger, who is the author of a book with co-author Jessica Stern called ISIS, The State of Terror, ISIS being Islamic State, the terrorist organization operating mainly in Iraq and Syria right now, but spreading its tentacles pretty much around the world. So I'm wondering, with their sophistication in social media, and that's what we're talking about, their recruiting tools using social media, did they do market research, JM, to identify specific target audiences and to tailor their approach to different groups? I mean, are they that sophisticated? For example, do they soft-pedal their presentation in terms of the violence in it, so that maybe young girls are seduced into leaving home and traveling to the Middle East to join them? Do they compartmentalize their marketing that way?
They do. It's their marketing is very targeted. So at the top level, you have statements that come from the organization's leadership, and those are aimed at everyone. And what will happen with those, something that they do that Al-Qaeda has not done consistently, is they'll release it in multiple languages. So when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who's the leader of ISIS, puts out a statement, it comes out simultaneous translations in English and French and German and Russian. So that's at the very high level. And then at the middle level, where they put out these very heavily produced videos, such as the executions of Westerners, you can definitely see differences from audience to audience. So for an Arab audience, for instance, they'll put out a video of the execution of Syrian regime soldiers, and those will be extraordinarily graphic. They will show an incredible amount of blood and gore relative to the executions of Western hostages, which were much more carefully edited. So in those videos, you would see the person, that the execution would start and then it would cut away to show the person's body at the end, and you didn't see all that happened in between. And I think that when people hear about beheading videos, I mean, they may have kind of an antiseptic idea of what these videos are like based on, you know, maybe you've read A Tale of Two Cities and you think about a guillotine and this is like a swift kind of execution. It's not. It's a very gruesome procedure. ISIS executes people with knives and not with swords or guillotines. And so there's a huge difference in the impact for the videos that they show for the Western audience, where, you know, you cut away from that act of violence, and the videos that they show for an Arab audience, which shows everything in painful detail.
Who are their main recruitment audiences? I mean, I know they recruit broadly, but is the center of their target area young Muslim males, or is it anyone anywhere who's sympathetic to them or alienated from their own life, wherever they happen to be? You know, what's their main focus?
Well, their primary areas that they recruit from are in the Middle East, places like Tunisia and Saudi Arabia and Libya, where they've really attracted the vast majority of their recruits. And those are a combination of social media use and on-the-ground networks. You know, they're people who know each other. They're geographically closer, so there's travel among these areas, and it sort of has a different complexion there. When they go out to the global audience on social media, that is much more sort of broadly targeted. And while they do have a particular impact on that sort of disaffected young male audience, you know, a lot of their propaganda is about their society that they're trying to build, the state that they're building. And they put out a lot of video, probably about a third of their overall content is devoted to depicting how their society works, how their caliphate works. And it shows everything from, you know, their consumer complaints division to showing how they make nursing homes for the elderly to traffic cops, doctors, hospitals, basically really trying to broaden the appeal so that you don't have to, they're not just seeking fighters, they're seeking people to come and live there. And what we've seen is that a lot of young women and in some cases whole families have moved there in response to this very specific appeal.
How do they handle receptive people like that they reach online? I mean, first, you know, how do they seduce them? Are there levels of, like, let's call it seduction and engagement to bring them in closer and closer? Or is it just a one-shot thing? Or how does that work?
It's very targeted. So they tailor their intervention to the audience they have. So in some cases, it can be, you know, very much resemble like online sexual predators grooming somebody. There was a fantastic story by Rukmini Kalamachi of New York Times that really just showed in detail. She interviewed somebody who had been courted by ISIS in this way and just really showed in amazing detail how much they lavished attention on their potential recruit, who was a young woman living in Washington State. And, you know, to the point of like they sent her chocolates and, you know, just made sure that every time she got online, there was someone there waiting to talk to her. So they'll look at the audience and each person gets kind of a tailored response. And then that's a very powerful way to approach this. And it's very difficult to program against it.
So it sounds like they prioritize maybe high-value targets are foreign people, particularly in the U.S. Do we have any idea how many foreign volunteers they've recruited at this point as fighters or as active participants? And I guess also then how are these, let's call them naive, foreign volunteers who travel there treated once they arrive and are confronted with the reality of the place?
Well, it's definitely thousands, probably low tens of thousands at this point of foreigners, both, you know, local foreigners in terms of coming from the Middle East and North Africa, and some thousands of Europeans have also gone to Syria, and we don't have real good visibility on how many of those join, for instance, Al-Qaeda in Syria or join ISIS, but there are many, and what they experience when they get there, we have some visibility on that, but not as much as we would like to have, I think. ISIS controls the flow of information out of its territories very, very carefully. So they, you know, they inspect people's phones to make sure that they're not tweeting unauthorized information. They've restricted Wi-Fi and internet in some areas so that only their message about what's going on there comes out. So we see a lot of imagery that they put out, videos and testimonies about how great things are there. And then, you know, we have reports from some activists in the area and some defectors that indicate that the reality is not as good as all of that. But even within those kind of defector and independent reporting channels, it's a little unclear. So we've seen reports in the media that suggested, for instance, that Mosul, its capital in Iraq, is in terrible shape and garbage is piling up on the streets and there are no services and no electricity. And then we've seen other reports, both of these in, you know, major Western newspapers that say that life has kind of returned to normal and things are settling down. So we don't have a great picture, but we do have testimony from defectors that suggests that it's just an incredible level of violence inside these areas, that its criminal justice system is incredibly violent. and that people have often just been kind of horrified or found themselves on the wrong end of ISIS's enforcers. But right now, I think that's an area where we need to do better. I think a U.S. government should deploy some intelligence assets to really exposing what's going on in these territories, because I think that's a powerful tool to kind of correct the image that they're able to project.
Listening to American Variety Radio, I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with J.M. Berger about ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and their use of social media, in particular in recruiting. J.M., is there any evidence that any of the recent shootings or bombings in the U.S. are directly attributable to this so far? For example, the Boston Marathon or the kind of attacks in Garland, Texas, on the people who were putting on a kind of a show of cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, things like that. I mean, I don't know, the Fort Hood shooter. I mean, some of these people seem like self-styled jihadis who are really just disturbed people, but others seem to have been influenced by somebody. So is it ISIS that's influencing some of them? The Boston Marathon young guys, for example.
Well, the marathon guys were influenced more by Al-Qaeda and by Chechen jihadists, as far as we can tell. Hmm. They hatched their plot and got involved in this movement prior to the rise of ISIS. Hmm. We see a lot of people who got radicalized before ISIS who have kind of squished their loyalty to ISIS over time. And in Garland, there was definitely, I mean, that was one of the clearest cut cases where ISIS supporters were encouraging these specific suspects to carry out that specific attack. So, you know, there's a social media trail there, and we can see that the shooters were deeply involved in ISIS social networks and were consuming this kind of content, including very specific exhortations to attack that specific event. So in a lot of these cases, we are seeing that, you know, there's a trail of breadcrumbs that leads to ISIS. Some of them are more clear than others, but, you know, in many of these cases, we are seeing that. Another thing that's really working in ISIS's favor is because sometimes these are kind of soft connections. ISIS can kind of pick and choose which random shooter it wants to adopt as one of its own and which ones it doesn't, and we pretty much let them do that. So, for instance, in the Sydney, Australia hostage saga from last year, there we had an individual who had been a Shia Muslim. He had a long history of violence and bizarre behavior. And, you know, 2 weeks before he took hostages in a chocolate store in Sydney, he took an interest in ISIS, decided he was like in favor of ISIS, and what he was going to do was in support of ISIS. And so ISIS said, okay, yeah, we'll take him. So this guy obviously had issues that went on before. And a lot of these individuals that we've seen have kind of, you know, issues with mental illness or past criminal behavior. And, you mm-hmm. know, I've written about this recently, is as a society, we need to understand when we're giving credit to ISIS appropriately and when we're letting them opportunistically seize something that doesn't really have that much to do with them. And that's a difficult, complicated task.
I think so far, all of the school and theater shooters have been just people with mental illness, just psycho, not ideological at all, from what I can recall. Is that pretty much true?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a mass shooting problem in this country that is very separate from an ISIS problem. But there's, you know, there's an overlap between those two areas. So some people who might be disposed toward or considering or have an impulse to kill people, you know, in a dramatic public way, might adopt ISIS as their pretext for doing that. You know, in other cases, we see people who are more ideological, or we see people who are not ideological at all, like James Holmes or Adam Lanza in Newtown, Connecticut. You know, I think there's a lot of gray areas in here, but a lot of these cases are certainly, the majority of these cases are not terrorism. They're not ideological. Hmm. And then we also have a problem with what we call terrorism. So, for instance, the Charleston church shooting was carried out by a guy with white supremacist intentions. And there was a very robust debate about whether to call this terrorism, which I think is completely appropriate. I think that we often are too fast to label violence by a Muslim as terrorism, and too slow to label violence by a white male as terrorism.
Hmm. Is there a chance that this whole thing, I mean, meaning the recruiting effort on the part of ISIS, might spread to what I could call a second generation of disseminators in Europe and the U.S., or people who are citizens of those countries and not even Muslim necessarily, but who would make support for ISIS more mainstream by using social media in a much more young people friendly, culturally recognizable way and maybe less violent, you know, to kind of just generalize and mainstream ISIS in a way that makes it more acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there is a high chance of that happening. I think what we're seeing here more is better understood as, you know, a phenomenon that's really kind of new for us with social media, which is that people who have fringe beliefs can find each other in ways that they could never do before. So the example I always use for this is if you were a radical jihadist living in Peoria in 1952, you might go your whole life and never meet anybody else who shared your views. And now, if you're that same person in that same town, you can get online and find hundreds of people who share your views immediately, and you can have relationships with them.
Sure.
Relationships that feel very real, even though the person is very far away. So I think that there's sort of this first wave of social change that's going to be produced by social media involves people who have these kinds of fringe beliefs are able to gather in large numbers and have a disproportionate impact on the rest of us. And I'm hoping that that's a phase that we will pass through and that more positive kind of social organization will come out of this. But ISIS is also like has a real apocalyptic bent. They believe the end of the world is coming. They believe that the caliphate they're creating is the perfect society that will precede the end of the world. And people like that are not necessarily going to be prone to moderate or to try and take their message to the mainstream. They're happy to only attract the chosen few.
So with all that going on, is there any effort on the part of the federal government here to counter this using, I don't know, social media or even just blocking the messages? And then also, what's the position of Facebook and Twitter and other companies where it passes through on dealing with it?
There's a lot of talk in government about how to counter this message and not very much action. And what action there is so far not been very effective. It's difficult for a government to, especially a government like ours, where we have rules and we want to, you know, present, always be truthful and always be fair and encouraging of diversity and kind of our democratic values. It's hard to do propaganda. And that's essentially what we're talking about when we talk about this. On the social media company side, each company has kind of a different attitude toward this. Google and Facebook have been in this kind of battle with jihadists and terrorism promotion for a couple of years now. They've been developing tools, and in the case of Facebook, been very aggressive in taking on people who support terrorism. In the case of Twitter, they're a younger company, and also they have kind of a libertarian bent. It took them a while to really decide that they wanted to address this problem. They are doing some things now, and they have suspended thousands of accounts, but they are still kind of struggling, I think, to find their footing and figure out where they want to be. I think there's an understandable reluctance on the part of these companies to be these arbitrators of what kind of speech is acceptable and what kind of speech isn't. I can understand why a company wouldn't want to be the one to decide where to draw the line, whose content gets to stay and whose content gets to go.
Well, Jay Emberger, this is obviously one of those topics we could easily talk for another half hour about, but we're going to have to cut it off there. Again, the book is ISIS, The State of Terror by Jay Emberger, Berger. Mr. Berger's website is at intelwire.com, intelwire.com, full of a lot of information along these lines and more. I want to thank you for being on with us on American Variety.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.